Welcome to This Week in Money and Happy New Year. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us the U.S. stock market had two different tales from the Dow and NASDAQ. He takes a look at the U.S. and Canadian dollars, crude, gold, and Tesla. Author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble, John Rubino, ponders whether we're headed into a recession or maybe something even worse, including World War III. He says gold is a good hedge in troubled times. Publisher of the RealEstateTiming.com newsletter, Robert Campbell, chats about U.S. and especially Californian real estate and how a downturn in building permits is the best indicator of where the economy is headed. He also has some mental and physical fitness tips. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartSpyRoss. Welcome back to the show and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year. And as we wind the year down, it's been a pretty eventful year for a lot of people in the markets. We went from being just a great upside momentum out of the COVID lows all the way for a year and a half into November, December of a year ago. And since then, it's been quite the sort of debacle in some of these stocks, and very few of them have managed to hold up.
You say in the U.S. it was a tale of two different stock markets. Can you explain?
Well, truly it was. And, you know, we talked about the NASDAQ stocks back in the first quarter of the year and how they and things like these innovation stocks, the ones that are in like ARK, the ETF of all new innovations, as an example, how much it looked like the 2000 bubble, 22 years ago, where the market was, the value stocks were doing very poorly. And all the dot-coms were just doing famously. We had the same appearance there in the NASDAQ into the November-December highs of a year ago. And as we've moved through this last 12 months, the NASDAQ group have just continued to stay under greater pressure than the general market. You know, we've had rallies, but they've been feeble rallies, short-lived, and then an erosions down to new lows again. You know, whereas if we take a look at the Dow has managed to have a sell-off along with everything else. However, we're not that far, really, off the highs of a year ago. We've recovered half of the losses that occurred into the summer. And then if we look at the S&P, which is sort of the midpoint of those two, it had a decent recovery into November. It only recovered about a third of the loss from the highs, and it's under pressure at the tail end of the year. So you have two different markets out there. I still think at this point NASDAQ and the high flyers, although they're oversold and due for a bounce, and that would be indicative then of tax selling coming to a conclusion here. And I guess the real granddaddy of the group here was Tesla, which gave capitulation signals for us on Monday of this week when it was down in the low 120s. And the stock managed to put in a capitulation low on Tuesday, Wednesday. And for us, that was only the sixth signal of that level since the stock trading started trading back in 2011, and each one of those have very nice recoveries. So at this point, the stock's about 123 on Tesla, and the bounce has probably got a little more steam in it. And if Musk is settling back on selling his stock, you know, maybe this is something that gets into the 150 bracket, which, coming off a low of around 110, is a pretty good move. Doesn't help anybody who's been in it for an extended period of time, but definitely is the type of thing where catching the falling knife does work when you find the right capitulation signals. And the stock at this point is up about 8% since the reversal on Wednesday. The options are up anywhere from 40 to 60% in that same time interval.
What's the story with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
We're into a seasonal period as far as the U.S. dollar for finding a low here. And the index has just been stuck in a tight trading range around the 103.5 to 104.5 range. It closed right down at the bottom end of the range to close off the year at 103.50. This is still generally a support area in terms of looking at the a Fibonacci retracement from the lows 2 years ago. So this is a 38% retracement, and that would be normal to find support. We're also still just, this is what now, about 4 weeks that we've been just straddling the 50-week moving average. And I think if it starts to give up some ground here, I don't think you look for too much more. Maybe in the 101.5 to 102 range is where you find the next level of support. As far as the Canadian dollar is concerned, didn't get much of a bump at the end of the week with the good oil price, but it's holding in here, 73.5. I still think it's got downside bias to it, and for now, just look at it as a trading range. Typically, it would be down into February, March, in terms of creating a bottom seasonally. So, let's look at and see how well it does. For now, resistance really was on the last decent bounce of 74.5. So, as long as it stays below that, consider the trend to be down.
What's the story for gold and silver?
Mentioned last week that seasonally you got an 80 to 85% chance of rallying from here through into February in either of those markets. Silver became overbought 2.5 weeks ago, and it's just been going through a bit of a pause. The gold market has just been grinding slowly higher. Nothing big to speak of. But it has been enough to keep the upside bias in place. And we take a look at the miners, like the GDX. They're not outperforming very well at this point, sort of midpoint of the last 3 or 4 weeks range. Would really have to see it get through 30 to gain some momentum here. And as I mentioned, if we're in the seasonal window that's positive for the precious metals, you want to make sure that the trend does remain up. It has been a reasonably good trend since we had that particular sequential buy signal back in late October. So as long as the bias remains up, corrections hold around, the 20-day average would be ideal, but the 50 would be allowable in our work. So keep stops in there, but not too close at this point. Give it the chance to do a little bit of ups and downs, some volatility as we move through January. But in February, if things are good, you want to see it gain some momentum rather than roll over. Because the years that have rolled over early have been pretty rough for the March-April stretch. So be cautious as far as those ones are concerned as we sort of work our way through the latter part of January.
What's happening on the energy front?
A decent little bounce at the end of the week on the crude oil market, and closed off the week at 82 and change, which is best, or sorry, at 80.32, which is one of the best levels we've seen recently here. At this point, we've got, I would say, a pretty good chance to see some strength coming out of here. Look at the 85 to 86 level as resistance. The other thing you want to keep in mind is that gasoline, if you take a look at the ETF there, the UGA, we are entering a seasonal period where you would tend to see strength for the next number of months. So take a look at any corrections as far as the UGA is concerned as buying opportunities for not just a short-lived trade, but something you might want to be holding for a few months.
Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us, and have a happy and prosperous New Year.
And one and the same to everybody you know and all of our listeners.
My guest has been Ross Clark from ChartsAndMarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at Charts by Ross. Coming up, John Rubino next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Washington State near Port Angeles. Welcome back to This Week in Money and Happy New Year.
Hey, Jim. Happy New Year to you, too.
Going into the new year, do you expect a recession?
Well, you know, we are probably, when all is said and done, they're going to go back and say we're already in a recession at this point, because there's a lot of negative things happening out there that that I think will be big enough to swamp whatever positive numbers the system is generating going forward. For instance, just take a few from the many. Housing in the U.S. is tanking faster than it did during the 2008-2009 housing crash, and that was a big one. Car sales are slowing down, and prices are starting to fall after spiking dramatically in the last couple of years. The yield curve is aggressively inverted, and normally that's a recession indicator. This time it's bigger than usual. You know, we've got more of the yield curve inverted in the U.S. by more than usual prior to past recessions. So that's a very serious recession indicator. And probably the biggest of them all is that the money supply, after increasing through hell and high water over the last 20 years, is actually shrinking now. So you cannot have a functional, highly leveraged system with a shrinking money supply, because basically the economy that we've devised now around the world is a Ponzi scheme, where it works kind of sort of as long as the central bank, wherever you are, is pumping new cash into the system and the overall money supply is growing. Shift that into reverse, and all the leveraged entities out there that depend on cheap money in basically infinite quantities don't work anymore. So a shrinking money supply for even a little while longer will blow up a huge number of over-leveraged financial institutions and governments and individuals, and that'll bring on a recession if it hasn't already happened. So you add all that up, and you got a dramatically slowing economy, probably tipping into a recession this year, if not this month.
Now, of course, some people said technically we've been in a recession because the U.S. had two quarters with negative growth. The administration denies it's a recession. No, everything's going fine. Can you trust the numbers that they give you saying it could be positive versus negative, or are they so massaged, to put it politely, that you really can't trust any of the stats coming out of the government?
No, you can trust exactly zero of what comes out of the government.
which makes the whole, you know, what's the economy doing question really hard to discuss because all the numbers are false. But I think it's safe to say that the numbers are false in one direction, which is to say the favorable direction for the government. So when the numbers that the government is releasing start to look bad, and we know they're actually much worse than whatever the government is saying, we can safely assume that things are pretty bad right now, you know, and I think that's, you know, that's definitely a safe assumption for the year ahead, that bad numbers coming from the government mean horrendous numbers in the real economy.
What would a recession mean for stock prices?
It'd be really bad at first. You know, if the economy starts to shrink, that by definition means corporate profits are going to shrink too, because a shrinking economy means less consumer spending and therefore less sales for the big companies that we buy stuff from. And if corporate profits shrink, then it's not clear what the driver is for anybody who's wanting to buy stocks. Because in today's world, a lot of bonds yield more than stock dividends pay, which means, you know, it's a better cash flow idea to be in medium-term fixed income, which makes stocks less attractive than, say, 3 to 5 year treasury bonds from a cash flow standpoint. And, you know, we're already seeing a lot of companies report bad numbers. And I would expect in the year ahead, with a shrinking money supply, inverted yield curve, slowing consumer spending, et cetera, that should be really bad for corporate earnings, and that in turn should be bad for stock prices. The good part of the story for stock prices is when everybody thinks we've bottomed, or the economy has bottomed. Because then people will start looking ahead 6 months to rising corporate profits and maybe buy stocks at that point. But, you know, that's a long way off. You know, that's probably not a 2023 story. That's more of a two-year time frame before people actually start getting optimistic again about the trend. So I'd say what's baked into the cake right now is not good for stock prices.
How will central banks respond to negative growth?
Well, they feel like they have to continue to tighten monetary policy, even in the face of near-term low growth or negative growth, because they were so freaked out by the inflation that we had in the past year, that they cannot let that reemerge. And so they're going to be tighter than they would be otherwise, which means they won't respond to negative growth right away. You know, they'll feel like they have to stick with tight monetary policy longer than their impulses tell them to and they would normally. So central banks won't respond at first to slowing and then negative growth, but eventually they'll capitulate, you know, because we can't have negative growth in a world this highly leveraged without risking blowing up the whole thing. In other words, having, you know, Credit Suisse implode and then that pulls down Deutsche Bank and then half the other European banks and a bunch of European or U.S. banks just flat out die. And we get something like 2008, but much worse because a massive amount of QE is not imminent. And so we'll have Lehman moment after Lehman moment after Lehman moment if central banks don't capitulate. So what they're going to have to do is, even in the face of people telling them they need to stay tight for longer, they will at some point capitulate. That's probably a later in 2023 story when things get really gnarly out there and central banks finally give up. But so much damage will have been done by then that the amount of easing that's going to be necessary to counteract it is going to be immense. I mean, we might be back to negative interest rates in the not-too-distant future just because so many big, scary, high-profile financial institutions will be blowing up. So we will see. But that's out there in the future somewhere and probably not much more than the intermediate-term future.
Now, going into this situation, in the U.S., about 11 million jobs were wanting, in Canada, roughly a million. By the time they find the people for those positions from folks who were laid off, Again, will that confuse the numbers so much that the central banks will continue to up interest rates at a time when really they don't need to?
That might be part of the story, part of the rationale for staying tighter longer. But, you know, you probably saw in the U.S. we overstated the number of new jobs that have been created by some massive number. And we did that heading into the midterm elections. You know, they basically lied about the labor market being much stronger and much tighter than it really was so they could get reelected. And then they reversed all those numbers out. So it turns out the U.S. labor market is not nearly as strong as we've been led to believe. You know, hence, don't believe the government. They're lying about everything. So, you know, it's not clear that the U.S. labor market is all that tight right now. We'll see. But, you know, the numbers that were coming out over the past year, which turned out to be lies, made it seem like the labor market was extremely tight. And now you've got big tech laying people off all over the place and other companies announcing, you know, less extreme but still real layoffs. So I think the labor market has hit peak tightness and will be easing going forward just because of so many big layoffs that are in the pipeline now and haven't yet hit.
Even Amazon says it's going to put its massive warehouse building program on hold for the time being.
I think they're talking about 100,000 people being laid off from Amazon.
Yeah.
And a lot of the other big tech companies are laying off notable amounts of people. Nothing like Amazon's 100,000, but still. The big tech companies were the bright spots in the economy over the past couple of years. And they almost single-handedly, the five or six of them in the FANGs complex, they almost single-handedly lifted the S&P 500 above zero growth over the past couple of years. So you take them out of the equation. Oh, and by the way, their stocks have tanked too. Amazon is the first company in history to lose $1 trillion of market cap, which they did in the past year. So not only are they seeing their businesses slow down and lay people off, but their market values are shrinking dramatically. And that creates something called the wealth effect, but in reverse, which is where if your stocks are up, you feel brilliant and you're more likely to buy frivolous things. But if your stocks tank, like if you're an Amazon or a Facebook investor, then you no longer feel smart and you no longer feel that rich. So you're likely to pull in your horns spending-wise. You know, maybe you won't buy that private jet after all this year, and that slows the economy down too. So I think that wherever you look, there are reasons to be pessimistic about this economy.
The Tesla stock plunge, is that something so dramatic that it's worthy to be news all on its own apart from the rest of the stock market?
Well, yeah, Tesla was almost the only tech bubble stock that remained there for a while, and then it rolled over, partially because Elon Musk became a political figure in buying Twitter, which makes Teslas no longer attractive for the virtue signaling crowd, which turned out to be a big part of their market or their customer base. So all of a sudden, a Tesla is not a way you signal that you are a good liberal, blah, blah, blah. And that's led to a decline in demand for Teslas. So their stock price has tanked. You know, that's a frustrating story for me because I was short Tesla for like two straight years, and it went up and it went up and up. And you know, I had options, which finally, you know, the time value of options starts to get kind of dicey towards the end, and you need to sell them before they expire with zero value. So I cashed out of mine just before all this stuff happened. You know, Tesla has been a brilliant short for the last 3 or 4 months. Unfortunately, I was forced out by my options starting to expire 5 months ago. So anyhow, painful story. But yeah, I think Tesla has basically joined the other big tech stocks in shedding half their value or more. And there's no reason to think that Tesla's business is going to improve in the face of a dramatically slowing economy. So it's probably not a great buy right now, unless Elon Musk does something like resign from Twitter and promise to never sell another Tesla stock, something like that. That would help its stock price. But barring that, it's not in a good macroeconomic place, as and neither are the other big tech stocks.
Are people also waiting for cheaper EVs to appear on the market as the big car makers get into the biz?
Well, car batteries are getting much more expensive because there just isn't enough of all the many exotic materials that go into lithium-ion batteries to satisfy full demand going forward. And I think it was the Ford F-150 electric. I might be wrong about this, but I think that's it. Their pickup truck. It came out at one price. Then they raised the price. Then they raised the price again. Then they raised the price again. So now it's vastly more expensive than it was when they first started taking orders. And I suspect that those same kinds of cost pressures are operating across the EV world. And because of that, we're not going to see cheaper electric vehicles anytime soon. This isn't one of those tech stories like big screen TVs where they go down in price by 25% a year forever. You know, electric vehicles have supply chain issues that they have to solve before they become cost competitive at the purchase point with internal combustion engine cars. So, you know, the EV story hasn't quite matured yet. And it's got a lot of moving parts and a lot of pluses and minuses, but I think it's safe to say that it's got a few more years, maybe more than just a few more years, before everything's in place for a total electric vehicle takeover.
Also, there's the matter of electricity supply. I don't see any new power plants or hydroelectric dams being built. And if everybody goes to electric vehicles, where's all this electricity going to come from? In California, people are asked to park their EVs because they had rolling brownouts due to forest fires.
Yeah, that is one of the funny things. California just passed a new law mandating that, you know, X number of the cars on their roads be electric, some big number. You know, it was really an aggressive law, even in a favorable market for EVs. And then their electricity grid started to flake out, and they ordered the people with electric cars not to charge them. You see, these are some really badly run states in the U.S. We've got kind of an experiment going on between different models of state governance, and the results couldn't be any clearer so far, that there's a model that works and a model that doesn't. And California is the poster child for the model that does not work. So we'll see how it all goes. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right that the electrical grid has to become a lot more stable before we can electrify the world. We couldn't do it today. We could not supply the power to 100 million electric cars in the U.S. today. A lot of things have to happen before we're able to do that. And, I think, interestingly enough, all the stuff that we've been talking about so far points to uranium as one of the hot sectors going forward. Because if we're going to electrify North America, let's say, then we need massive amounts of new electricity. But, you know, where we are geographically makes wind and solar not the solutions for everybody. You know, maybe in Texas or someplace like that, or Arizona, you can put solar panels on every roof, use that to charge your electric car, and you're good to go. But the further north you go, the less viable that strategy is. And we don't want to switch back to coal. We certainly don't want to burn oil, because that's the dirtiest electricity generating fuel. And natural gas is one of the logical alternatives, but it probably won't do the whole thing. So I think nuclear power is coming back in style dramatically because of all this. And here again, there isn't enough uranium coming out of today's mines to be able to satisfy the nuclear plants that are now on the drawing board. So somehow, some way, we got to find a lot more uranium, and that's going to take higher prices. So that's a very interesting play that emerges from all of this going forward.
Is the petrodollar about to be replaced by the petro yuan?
Maybe. The U.S. has abused the power that it's had as the dominant financial entity in the world, you know, with a reserve currency and with the control over the international bank clearinghouse system. We were not benevolent dictators in all of this. We've used the dollar and the SWIFT banking system as weapons. And we've antagonized a big part of the world. And then you get the Ukraine war, which, let's face it, we engineered, and all kinds of other things going on out there. So it's not a surprise that Russia and India and China and now Saudi Arabia are forming a financial and currency bloc of their own, where they trade with each other in their own currencies, which could mean that China gets to buy Saudi Arabian oil with yuan. That makes it less necessary for everybody to hold huge amounts of dollars and might make it necessary for people to start accumulating yuan. So, and they're talking about backing their currencies with gold over there. You know, China and Russia are the big buyers now among the world's central banks of gold. And if they, if they have a currency that is viable for buying oil and it's backed by gold, then you've got a very serious challenger to the dollar out there. You know, it's not a done deal at all, because the capital markets of something like a Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, Brazil alliance wouldn't be nearly as deep and as trustworthy as U.S. capital markets. So they would not have risk-free bonds trading over there yet. So a lot has to happen before it's an even battle between the petro-yuan and the yuan and the petrodollar. But any kind of competition at all is potentially disastrous for the dollar, because there are, 20 trillion extra dollars floating around out in the world right now? And if a lot of them turn out to be surplus, they're going to come back here looking for U.S. assets to buy. And that's going to be incredibly inflationary, which is to say it forces the value of the dollar down. So it's a very big deal what's happening, and it's potentially very dangerous for the dollar. So it definitely bears watching, and it definitely means you want to own gold and silver in an environment where you have multiple competing currencies out there and the dollar's not the the dominant piece of paper in the world.
So where do gold and silver fit into the chaos expected in 2023?
Well, that's the asset that gold and silver, precious metals in general, are the things you want to own as safe havens in a chaotic world. Because we've got, you and I just went through like 10 different really scary things that are happening in the world right now. All of those reverberate back to individual buying decisions and prices in stores and inflation. And because of that, financial assets, that is to say government bonds and bank stocks and things like that, are going to be at risk, because they depend for the value for their value on the value of these fiat currencies out there. And so you make the fiat currencies extra volatile and threaten the existence of some of them, and all of a sudden financial assets don't work anymore. So you want to own real stuff, real assets. So farmland, oil wells, even coal mines, uranium mines for sure, and gold and silver. Those things can't be created on an electronic printing press. They will tend to go up in value as the world's currencies go down in value. And that's how you protect yourself going forward. And then, of course, also you've got the mining stocks, the companies that have this stuff in the ground and get it out and sell it for these ever-depreciating currencies. A good portfolio that includes physical gold and silver, some energy stocks, some precious metal stocks, and not much else will probably do really well in the next 5 to 10 years.
Countries like Canada and the UK sold off their gold at bargain basement prices. Russia and China have been accumulating gold at a terrific rate over the last 7-8 years. What does this do to the monetary situation of the world that you were talking about previously?
Well, the guys who have the gold are going to tend to have the stronger currencies. So people sold all their gold. I suspect that the U.S. just ordered a few companies to do that, or countries to do that. Most of what's happening in the world is bad is America's fault. And that could be too. Cause there's no real, explanation otherwise why a sovereign country with a central bank that whose currency needs to be backed would get rid of their gold, because you know you can print more of your own currency and buy more treasury bills if that's what you want to buy. You don't have to sell your gold to do it. But those guys did, and I think they will pay a price for it. Although, you know, Canada is a resource-based economy to begin with. So you can make the case that your country is the gold backing and the energy backing of your currency, because you've got so much of it in the ground. So I wouldn't be worried about you guys. But Britain, man, they really didn't have the leeway to go gold free, and I'm afraid they'll pay a price for it.
John, anything else we should be keeping a close eye in 2023?
Oh, there's so much. I mean, the geopolitics is just terrifying out there. We're literally trying to start a nuclear war. And by we, I mean the U.S. We keep handing Ukraine more and more sophisticated weapons that they can use to maybe even defeat Russia, who is going to be left with nothing but nukes and an unwillingness to let NATO, an anti-Russia military alliance, expand all the way to its borders. So, you know, we're putting them in a very tough spot. And it's completely possible that sometime in the next few months, we're going to have Russians and Americans killing each other on the battlefield. And, you know, all of this finance stuff that we're talking about, it becomes completely irrelevant in that case. So, you know, it's completely possible that we'd be looking at World War III, where by the middle of next year, in which case it doesn't matter if the yield curve is inverted or oil prices are $70 or $150. You know, just none of that stuff matters, because we're on the verge of annihilating ourselves. So, you know, hopefully it doesn't come to that, but we're making dumb mistakes that take us in that direction. And, you know, that's my big wish for 2023, is that some of us, you know, some of the people in charge of the world come to their senses and pull back from this stuff, cut some peace deals, and then turn their attention to all the other problems that they have.
John, thank you so much for chatting with us, and have a happy and prosperous new year.
Thanks, Jim. You too.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. Coming up, Robert Campbell, next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, author of Timing the Real Estate Market and the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter. You can find him online at realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from beautiful San Diego. Bob, welcome back to This Week in Money, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jim. Thank you. Thank you for having me on again.
When can we expect the next issue of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter?
I'm working on it right now. It's going to come out January 15th, 2023. I publish it every 2 months. That's all I need to publish it, because real estate trends move rather slowly, particularly when you compare them against stock market trends. And so once every 2 months is good enough. It doesn't detract from the value of it, and it gives you all the information you need. So I'm working on it right now.
Is your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, an important read during times like this?
Well, I think it's an important read at all times if you're a real estate investor, because I'm, of course, biased, but that's the reason I wrote the book. You know, it's not only – the reason I publish my timing letter is not only to give people research, do research for people and give them timing signals, but it's to teach them how to do it on their own. It's fully disclosed what I do. that, you know, anybody could do what I do if they just applied themselves. So there you are, you know, you give a man a fish, that, you know, even my timing letter, you know, gives a man a fish, but you know, everything I show, it teaches them how to fish too. So, but most people aren't going to do it. I know that. So I tell everybody everything, you know. Yeah, there's some secrets I keep, but they're very small. But I just tell everybody, people can go, well, that's a lot of work. And they go, yeah, it is a lot of work. But I can do a lot of work because I can spread that cost over, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of subscribers. If you're just doing that for yourself, and unless you like only doing that stuff for yourself, you know, you get a kick out of it, which is fine, you're better off just subscribing to me. And most people do.
The Fed and Bank of Canada both increased their rates by 50 basis points this month. Are higher interest rates likely to be the trend in 2023?
Yep. It's going to be higher interest rates for quite a while. I mean, there's no way they can get away from inflation. In fact, you know, you saw, you know, Treasury bonds or something here in the United States, since the inflation, they fell like 40% in value. Then all of a sudden they had a 15% rebound or so in the last 2 or 3 months. Now they're heading back down to near the old lows again. So they're going to take out the old lows. That you know, in general, interest rates, mortgage rates in particular, with respect to real estate, are going to be higher in 2023 than they were in 2022.
What's the latest on U.S. housing markets, especially California, for sale prices and volumes?
The market has turned. I mean, we're clearly in a downtrend right now, and both nationally and in California, especially in California. California, the three major housing markets I follow in California, San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, and San Diego, those are three of the weakest housing markets in the United States right now. So, but in other places in the United States aren't quite as bad as the California cities. But one area, Florida, Tampa, and Miami, which I follow, they're still kicking ass. So Florida's still doing Florida's the best performing real estate in the United States right now. It hasn't turned down. It's still going up. But most all other places are going down, especially California.
Are the cities that got hit the worst in the 2008 real estate crash likely to be the ones that get hit the worst this time around?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the case. That you look at something like Las Vegas and Phoenix, they both fell like 65% home values during the 2006 through 2012 decline, and then all of a sudden they've rebounded the most. They're above the old highs. So I'd be afraid of those more than anything else. And especially Phoenix, when I'm working on my timing letter right now, I'm looking at Phoenix. Building permits, new home building permits is one of my five key indicators that I follow. Phoenix, new home building permits have literally fallen off a cliff in the last 2 or 3 months. I mean, most cities, major cities, go through, you know, gradual decline. Phoenix, it looks like a high dive from 200 feet. So I think Phoenix is going to get clocked.
Is this real estate bear market likely just getting started?
Yes, it is. To use a baseball analogy, I would say that we're in the just starting the second inning.
So it doesn't matter who the reliever is. It's way too early in the game to put him in.
Yeah, there's no time for relievers yet, Jeff. You hope that you just got to try to survive the first six innings somehow before you bring the relievers in.
Do real estate markets tend to take economies down with them, but not stock markets?
Absolutely. If you go back and look at recessions in the United States and compare it against trends in new home building permits, that weakness in construction, new home building permits, takes the economy into recession, and an upturn in new home building permits / construction takes it out. It's so predictable. And the reason that is such a key indicator to watch from an economic standpoint as well as a market timing standpoint for when to buy and when to sell is 15% of the U.S. economy is based in some manner or form on real estate construction real estate sales or something to that effect. And so, in other words, nothing else is even close. I understand from a dollar and cent standpoint, number two is cars because they're so expensive relative to everything else. But the housing by far, watch that. You know, that brings the cycles down and it brings the cycles up. And you can go back 50 years and study the charts, and you can see it's clear as day. And with respect to what's happening right now, that, you know, sales are down monumentally across the board. However, building permits are just starting to go down. Like in California, they're still up 1.4% year over year. That's nothing. And the United States, I think they're, what is that number? I haven't figured that one yet, but permits are weakening. Of course they're weakening. You know, people are scared. Buying a new home, a brand new home is super expensive, especially at today's, you know, mortgage rates that are, you know, almost double or more than double than they were a year or two ago. So affordability is just a key problem. And now mortgage rates are going to start going back up again, and so it's just going to price more and more people out of the market, and prices are going to go down. They're going to have to reduce prices in order to attract buyers. People are going to notice that, and they're going to say, okay, I'm not buying until this trend changes. Hmm. And, you know, so goes the ride to the bottom.
Now, in the U.S., most people get a 30-year mortgage, so once you take out a mortgage, you're stuck with it pretty, you know, for your lifetime of owning that house until it's paid off. In Canada, people take out variable mortgages. So, yeah, it's very painful when rates are going up, but when they're going down, it's nice to be paying less and keeping the same real estate.
Everybody's a genius when housing prices, you know, like when mortgage prices are going down.
Yeah.
Everybody's, you know, got their bankruptcy attorney on speed dial for when they're going up. Because, I mean, I can't imagine what it's like that you're tied to that. To me, that would, you know, make the cycles more extreme. But I know what the cycles have been in Canada, and it's almost been up, 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 up. There are no down cycles. Now, I don't know how that happens, but that's what the charts say.
Did the Biden administration change the definition of a recession? And if we're in one, how long and how deep could it be?
Well, politicians are always changing the, you know, the calculations used for a recession or all those kind of things. So I don't listen to politicians. I just follow key indicators like, for example, new home building permits. You know, that's a key indicator. And I have two other things I'm looking at for recession indicators too. You know, conference board confidence indexes, 6-month moving averages, and a few other things like that have been almost have almost had 100% reliability for predicting recessions. So we are going into a recession, you know, one way or another. And the only reason that we're not in a recession right now is because the U.S. government is spending let's just call it $2 trillion more than they're taking in for tax revenues. And those $2 trillion factor right into the GDP. So the U.S. government could spend $1 trillion hiring knuckleheads to use toothbrushes to clean the sidewalks in every city in the United States. U.S. GDP would go up by $1 trillion. Is there any value there, Jim? Zero. Total waste. But is it factored into GDP? Of course it is. That's why, you know, following GDP, that's just like it's something I don't do very closely because it's flawed. You know, the more the government spends, the higher the GDP, you know, and it's the government. You give the government, you know, a dollar in tax revenue and maybe 25% of gets spit out at the other end in the form of something that's a benefit or something of productive value.
What are some recession indicators to look for on the street as the economy gets worse and worse?
Well, again, it's you know, it's not that complicated. Follow building permits. That's your best indicator. Also, there's the inverted yield curve. That's already inverted, so we should be in a recession. But, you know, we're in a recession, like, slightly for 2 quarters. But by the definition, we're in a recession. Now everybody's predicting the, you know, that fourth quarter GDP. to be somewhere in the 2 to 3% range, and it's just a joke. It's just a joke. So I don't even pay any attention to those kind of things. With another key indicator to watch is, even though it's a lagging indicator, is unemployment. Unemployment is 3.7% in the United States. That's near a record low. So our economy, from that standpoint, is doing just fine.
How accurate do you think the GDP numbers are?
Not at all. Not one little bit. Like I say, you know, the government can just increase its government spending. It's deficit spending, you know, where money is created out of thin air. You know, they'll just go out and float another $2 trillion with the Treasury bonds, and the Federal Reserve, the money will be printed to cover that, and they'll give it to the government to spend. And so the national debt goes up by $2 trillion. What's interesting, listen to this. In the United States, they said, you know, in 2022, they said the national deficit was $1.4 trillion. And what that means, the U.S. government spent $1.4 trillion than it took in tax revenue. Okay, that's the measure right there. Interestingly, it was way more than that. Did the national debt, therefore, go up $1.4 trillion in 2022? No, it went up $3 trillion. So much of this is off balance sheet items, guys. Off balance sheet. You know, look at the debt. All of a sudden, we're $3 trillion deeper in debt in the last 12 months, yet they say the national deficit is only up less than half of that. That doesn't make any sense at all. So they're spending money that they're not telling you about.
Does an ongoing shortage of workers signify anything for the economy going forward?
That's a good question, and I really don't have an opinion on that because I don't trust any of the numbers. You know, the government's been handing out so much free money, you know, in the past couple of years and all this other stuff. I don't know who wants to work and who doesn't want to work anymore. I just know that the work ethic is going down the toilet here in the United States. You know, for sure, nobody wants to work anymore. A lot of people don't want to work because of the COVID thing. The COVID thing said, if you want a job, you have to be vaccinated. A lot of people didn't like that as a requirement for a job. Like, who the hell are you, anybody, to tell me how I should run my own personal health, right? So it's either my job or get jabbed. So they got jabbed. A lot of those people that, you know, where they're having side effects right now are not happy. They're not happy at all. So I know a lot of those people feel like, gee, that, you know, the old days, let's call it the old days when I grew up as a kid. You know, you'd work for a major corporation for 50 years. Everything was good. You get a retirement. There was security in that. They left you alone. You just did your job, and you worked for them for 50 years, have a nice retirement income, and you get a gold watch. That doesn't happen anymore. There's none of that. People don't work for anybody for 50 years anymore. They don't trust them. All of a sudden, they come in, and they put some requirement on them. You know, oh, you need to do this in order to work for us. Some a very private matter. Private matter that's guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. But, you know, I mean, but you still have the choice to say no, and a lot of them do, and they're pissed off. That's why morale is in the toilet.
Your thoughts on the U.S. dollar?
U.S. dollar. U.S. dollar is going to go up. I know it's had a sell-off, and that's because interest rates came down, but as the Fed continues to raise interest rates to fight inflation, which they're going to do, and as the Fed raises interest rates, mortgage rates are going to go up, and so are all U.S. documents, and the U.S. dollar is highly correlated with interest rates. When interest rates in the United States go up, so does the dollar. When interest rates go down, so does the dollar. So if I had to put money on where the dollar is going, like say in the next 12 months, it'd be higher.
Your thoughts on gold?
Well, I love gold, and I've loved gold for 20 years, and I think that gold's time is coming, and even though it's like, you know, it's been an underperformer compared to the stock market, it's one of those items I think that you want to own, have a big position in it over the course of a lifetime, because the way I look at it, it's the ballast in my sailboat. Is it convertible to cash? I can go down to a coin store and take my 1 ounce gold coins and convert them into cash in 10 minutes. Can you do that with real estate? No, you can't. I mean, real estate is the asset class I like the most. I know it the best. I've made the most money in it, and I'm good at, you know, timing the cycles, to buy low, sell high. I know how to fix up property, but gold is something that is, it's ever-present in my portfolio, and it's one of those things that, you know, when I started accumulating it 20 years ago, I said, when I get to be 65 or 70 years old, this is what I'm going to use to fund my retirement, help fund my retirement. I'm going to sell one ounce of gold every month until I die. Guess how many ounces of gold I've sold? I'm 75 now. Guess how many ounces of gold that I've sold in the last 10 years according to the plan I thought I was going to utilize? Zero. Isn't that funny? It's just something, I like it there. It makes me feel safe. It's safe. That's the way do I feel safe with the stock market? Are you kidding me? I mean, I love the market, because it's so volatile. I'm not a long-term buy and holder in the stock market by any means, nor am I in real estate. The only thing I'm a long-term buy and hold is gold. I buy it and I don't sell it. And that's something that I didn't invent myself. One of the people I respected most in the world was a newsletter writer called Richard Russell, wrote Dow 30 Letters for 58 straight years. He lived near me down here in La Jolla. That's what he did over the course of his lifetime. He just kept buying gold, buying gold, buying gold. And he wasn't motivated by money. He's just a smart guy, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I went, wow, what a way to live. Because you know what? It removes the worry out of life, guys. And just pretend that the money's not even there. And all of a sudden, if you really need it, you could take all your gold coins down to a coin shop, convert them into cash. And like I said, in 10 minutes, you got the cash you need. But the key is not to need it, you know. It's like the underground emergency oil reserve for the United States. You know, the thing is to put that emergency oil in the ground and then never use it, right? So that's what I feel about gold, and I still think that I'm very positive about gold. I think gold is going to be the premier wealth asset in the next 5 years. I think eventually everybody's going to have to, with all the debt out there that can't be practically serviced, that the only way that they can maintain, you know, hold on to the debt and maintain the debt and not let the whole debt structure collapse, which would mean a collapse of the economy, is to back the dollar by gold. Or maybe they're going to do it with the yuan. That's coming, guys. It's coming. I mean, is it a guarantee? No. Is it more than 50-50? Absolutely.
In uncertain times, are there safer places to store wealth?
Yeah, well, I mean, gold, but during uncertain times, it meant what kind of uncertain times? That I'm still a big believer in commodities. That, you know, during inflationary times, which we're in right now, episodes, commodities outperform everything else by a mile. So, and gold, of course, is commodities. But I'm talking about something like oil, for example. Food, you know, building products, metals, those things tend to really perform well during inflation. And this inflation ain't going away, guys. I mean, I know everybody like to say, oh boy, you know, we're going to get back to 2%. Uh-uh, ain't going to happen. Just study history. Study history. Study inflation. Typically when a country has an inflation rate of over 6%, and this has been studied countries all over the world. Over 6%, and we got up to 9 here, Dan said, how long does it take, on average, to get back to 2? 5 years. Are there exceptions to that? Yeah, sure there are. Sometimes it takes 2 years, sometimes it's 3. Other times, in some instances, I looked at the study, it took 8 to 10 years. But on average, it takes 5 years. So we're going to be living with inflation for a lot longer than people think.
Evidently, Tesla is currently the second most shorted stock. Does that make you want to short Tesla?
Actually, yes, because I'm a trend follower. But you know, with anything, I mean, you always want to invest with the trend. The trend is down, but then all of a sudden, so you would, even though I'm not a short seller, I'm a long only seller. But just let's just talk that hypothetically here. Yeah, I would short Tesla, at a certain point where it's all of a sudden it's heading down. Now all of a sudden it takes a blip up like it's done, it may have done the last couple of days. If it goes up as much as, you know, to meet my specifications for putting on a trade, I'd go short and I'd just put a stop loss in there, you know, and hope I don't get killed on a trend reversal. It keeps going up. I'd do that. That's a high percentage bet. I'm not going to go long. That's for sure. I mean, you know, you're fighting the trend. You're fighting the trend and you're fighting the Fed. Two bad investment choices.
Are there people in the world you would like to meet?
I'd like to meet Elon Musk. I think we could get along just, it would be fun meeting Elon Musk, going out and having fun with him. He's my kind of guy. I'd like to meet Donald Trump because he's a real estate man. I'm sure we'd have fun. Donald Trump's got, he's a fun kind of guy. I'd rather meet Musk more, but I'd love to go out and, because he's got a sense of humor, he's down to earth, he's apolitical. Oh, I'd love to go out and spend some time with him.
What are your thoughts on this quote on aging by Bill Maher? Don't let the old man in.
Wow. Well, here we go, guys. You ready? Now we're talking about the most important thing in life, which is your health. Second comes family. Third comes money. Don't let the old man in. That's the way that you keep moving forward in life and you outperform and you stay interesting. You stay young. You keep setting goals for yourself that most people, you know, that don't set goals anymore about what they're doing, either in a business sense or particularly, most importantly, in a health sense. Don't let that old man get inside of you. I am working out right now with a trainer, high-intensity trainer, and at 75 years old, the program we're using is SEAL training, Navy SEAL training, guys. I'm 75 years old, and I'm training like a friggin' Navy SEAL. Can I perform as one of those guys, do as many burpees or things that they do? No, but those are the exercises I'm doing, and it's making me strong. It's making me hard body. It's giving me confidence. It applies to everything in my life. There's nothing I can't think. There's nothing I believe that I can't do, either financially or from a health standpoint to advance my health. The old man will never, ever, ever get in my life because I'm moving ahead all the time, setting new goals. And I have to tell you guys that I don't know what you guys know as burpees, but it's a young man's exercise generally. So I was doing burpees the other day in the gym. I do 3 sets of 8. And, you know, a kid can probably do 3 sets of 40. Okay, 20 years old. I can't do that. Or in Marine training. So after I finished my final third set of 8 burpees, you know, my hands go automatically to my knees. I'm bent over, gasping for breath because I'm totally exhausted. I can't do anymore. I've reached that limit where I just can't do anything more. And I was reaching over, I turned my head and looked over at the side, and I made eye contact with one of the 3 Navy SEALs that works out in the same gym. And we've never talked before. I've seen him around before. I know what a badass he is. And our eyes made contact, and I couldn't even talk. I was out of breath. He looked at me and gave me the Hawaiian two-finger sign, like going like this, going like, wow, I'm impressed. That's hard. And so that's what I strive for, having a Navy SEAL look at a 75-year-old man that's doing burpees and going, that's badass. Now I'm in that club where I'm outperforming just like Navy SEALs outperform. What a high. He didn't have to do that. We've never even met. He was watching me do those burpees as he was walking past me, and he goes, those things are hard. I know they're hard. Is anybody else in the gym doing burpees? No, just this guy. And he's no kid, I'll tell you that, but he's doing it. I know, and I got that acknowledgement from him. Wow. So, I mean, that's what I live for, guys. You outperform. There's no finish line. You know, I started out doing 3 sets of 6. Now I'm doing 3 sets of 8. I'll probably move up to 3 sets of 10. But there comes a limit. There's only so many burpees you can do when you get to be 75 years old. I'm not going to do 40, 50 burpees like a 20-year-old can that's an athlete. I guess I could. It's not worth it. You know, it's not worth, it's not that important to me. 10, you know, doing 8 or 10 is fine because your body's getting hard and strong and you're losing weight and you're active and things like that. So there you are. There's no old man inside of me. And the reason I'm telling you guys this is not to brag. Maybe I'm bragging a little because I'm actually doing it, but I'd like to encourage all of you to do what I'm doing.
How are things going with your trainer, and how important is mental toughness in succeeding?
You know, the mental toughness is the whole thing. If you're not mentally tough, you're not going to perform at a high level, guys. That's what it is. You have to have the attitude, I can do this. I can do this. Like, let me use an example. Michael Jordan, was he mentally tough? Obviously. He could miss 20 straight shots, and all of a sudden he's ready to take the 21st shot. Do you think there's any doubt in his mind that that shot's not going to go in the basket? No, zero. And maybe the next 20 will go in. That's the mental toughness. You never, ever, ever give up in approaching your goals. That's why you just keep advancing. You get tougher. You just keep pushing yourself. I mean, in a good way. We're capable both physically and financially more than you think you're capable of. But unless you have that mental toughness to go out in the world, I mean, that's the best way to outperform. Because you just have that attitude. You have that attitude that you can't beat me, and whatever it is. And also, that when you're in business for yourself, people can sense that you have that confidence and that you're a guy that they want to be around, or that they, you know, want to use an advisor, that you're that confident and they're not. And it shows, and people are attracted to you for that reason, and therefore you're more likable, which is really important. Plus, you can do more business if money's your biggest motivation in the world, which is misguided, but that's the case with most people.
Is health important to enable mental toughness?
It's not important. It's a requirement. The only way that you can be mentally tough, that you can have strong mental health, is to have strong physical health. It's the only way. And that one leads to another because it helps your brain. You know, I've noticed most people talk about, oh, I'm having a senior moment. You know, I can't remember what my name is or something. I haven't had one senior moment in my life. My memory is probably as good as it's ever been, if not better. And it's all to the fact that you're physically tough and it helps develop that mental strength. Well, your brain's real sharp. You get smarter. It makes you smarter, guys. You want to get smarter? Get physically fit. Lift weights. You'll get smarter.
Is 2023 likely to be better in some areas than 2022 and worse in others?
I think it's going to be, from a financial standpoint in the markets, I think 2023 is going to be worse for the stock market. I think it's going to be worse for the bond market. And I think it's going to be worse for the real estate market. And I think it's going to be better for the gold market.
Are you optimistic as we head into the new year?
Oh, yeah. I am totally optimistic about the new year. And it's not from a standpoint that, because I know where my money is. I know where I'm telling people to invest their money. And are we buying real estate right now? Not in a million years. Nope. So we're not doing that. Are we buying stocks? I don't tell people to buy stocks. I don't do that. I tell people to buy gold. So it's going to be an amazing year. You can make it an amazing year. But are you going to make money in the stock market? Probably not. You're going to make money in the real estate market? Probably not. You're going to make profit in bonds? No. So how are you going to make it an amazing year? It's going to be self-improvement. Work on priority number one, guys, your health. Because, I mean, if there's any time to sit on your hands, if you've got idle cash, now is the time. And let's put it in commodities. That's, you can do that. Put it in commodities. That's the best thing. And now work on your health. Just, you know, and just become mentally tough, physically strong, and you've got the world eaten out of your hands. And let me tell you guys, there's nothing like it. I've been doing this my whole life, and I can tell you there is nothing like it. It gives you self-confidence. And that self-confidence shows in every aspect of your life.
Bob, how can people find out more about your book and your newsletter?
They can go to my website, realestatetiming.com, just like it sounds, realestatetiming.com, and they can read a sample issue. They can I publish a blog post every week or so. To give people followers of mine a taste of what they might be missing if they don't subscribe to my timing letter. But you can learn all about me. You can see what I do. You know, my education. I have a degree in economics from UCLA. I've been around the home building industry my entire life. My dad was a builder-developer for 55 years here in San Diego. So I know the real estate market, and I love it. And the best way to get ahead in the world, guys, is to do what you know best. If you're not good at the stock market, don't play the stock market. If you're not good at real estate, don't play the real estate. You know, but you got to be good at something. And you have to. That one of the secrets to life is this: whatever you make, spend less. Ever since I was an 18-year-old kid, if I made a dollar, I would save 10 or 15 cents, and I learned how to invest it. Always live beneath my means. Always. And all of a sudden, you get to be older, even though I will never retire. And all of a sudden, is money a big concern? Does that keep you awake at night? No, it does not, because you've always lived beneath your means. And so you have ballast in your sailboat, and you're going to be just fine in the world. Now work on your health, and you have a perfect life.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
And have a great new year.
You too, Jim.
My guest has been Robert Campbell, publisher of the RealEstateTiming.com newsletter. He was speaking to us from San Diego. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, John Rubino, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.